what I'm doing is a series about film and the different parts of making up film, from the director, producer, cinematographer. And what exactly would you define as a production designer's job?
Well,
to start off with the pedestrian question.
Production design started with a title that was used by William Cameron Menzies. And in his day, what he did was to draw out every shot in the picture for Sam Wood or for, in the silent days, for Doug Fairbanks. So that they storyboarded the whole film. That went out of fashion as directors became more and more specific sensibilities and had their own cameramen that they knew well and worked with. And certain things are still storyboarded, but they're done more for technical reasons than anything else, to solve a certain section of a picture that's very complicated. So the title was then used by people whose function was different than the ordinary art director. An art director it's a title that says something special about the visual look of a picture. Art directors are, for the most part, very often very good ones. During the years of, yes, when every studio had a large staff, and there was a big back lot, and sets were put up, only certain men at that time were trying to push overall tone of a film so that it was completely controlled and only right for that picture. And there are a few men who still do that. There are some in Europe who do it. It's a question of the approach. When you design a picture from beginning to end, you're making a series of choices based on a script that will unify every image in the picture, and you have a very specific reason for making those choices. They're not arbitrary. When you think of the number of possibilities in the script, everyone has to finally make a choice. It finally has to be this location, that interior. And as motion pictures became more technically mobile, art directing at one point, or designing at one point, was pretty much of a proposition on the stage when sound first came in. And for many years afterwards, all the films in the 30s, if you look at them carefully, for the most part, were done in studios on back lots. Location as a real part of a film didn't come in until after the war. The equipment was better, the lighting equipment was better, and people didn't want to get stuck in studios anymore. There was so much to say about other places. They went into cities. And a design picture can be entirely on location. Antonioni's a perfect example of a man who is not only a director, but pretty much of a production designer himself, where there are no sets. But it's designed. every image is part of this whole idea. Now, you must have the idea before you can make the choices. It's you keep looking with a script for the things that that script specifically needs. I don't mean in the functional sense, restaurant or office, but what it actually can become, since it's shot out of continuity, you have to have in mind the entire color of each set beforehand, because it's all going to be put together separately, done separately. Pictures like Chinatown and Shampoo and The Fortune are all based on ideas about the content of the particular story. Chinatown is a story about a drought in 1937. So that all the colors in it are the colors of dry grass.
It's psychological too. It's a psychological drought.
I mean, it's all drought. And it takes place in a period that you have to be very careful of, because it's coming back, and you don't want to be trendy. I mean, anything in Art Deco, you have to be very careful of, unless you're talking about people who were in themselves very trendy, very with it at that period. And in the case of Chinatown, there was nobody or nothing about the film that would lead you to believe that anything about those people. They were there at a certain time, and if something was new, then it was modern. That is, if Jack Nicholson, whose character is rather showy, had an office, he would be in tune with the time, whereas everybody else, not at all. But there is something in Art Deco that is also not in the object, but in the screen itself. That is, there's a certain simplicity to Art Deco, a certain geometric simplicity. And there are a lot of shots in Chinatown that are laid out to give you the sense of the 30s in terms of the shape of the screen, just what happens, how tall a window is, and just the simplest forms, you know, give you. Also, it's hot. And all the exteriors are all white buildings, and they're all Spanish. Now, every building but the little California bungalow is a completely interesting example of California Spanish architecture. And in their whiteness, you get the heat all the time. You know, we never shot on a cloudy day, ever. And the picture has a tone that each part fits perfectly with the next. There's only one color in all of Chinatown, only it's in various shades. In other words, it's either lighter or darker, but it's the same tone. And in a picture like Shampoo, you begin with a completely different series of ideas, and you get a completely different result. In the days of Cedric Gibbons, if Cedric Gibbons did a picture, it looked like the last picture Cedric did. I mean, it didn't have its own meaning. Shampoo is about vanity and about people with money who show you how much they have. In other words, where Chinatown you extract things to keep it simple. In Shampoo you add things. And these are people who, no matter how much they have, and no matter how much they're willing to show you they have, there is this obvious hole in the bucket, because their lives don't amount to very much. I mean, they can't, you can't put enough in.
Were they nouveau riche, or?
Well, yes, they're Beverly Hills people, and they're on different stratas. There's a very careful structure in Shampoo. Lauren, the poorest, lives at the lowest part of town, in what they call the Doheny Gulch. And as you rise in affluence, you get higher and higher up into the hills. And in California, in Beverly Hills, there are certain things you're always after. Indoor-outdoor living is the nature of this place. And there's not a single set except Beatty's Little Dump. A single home that you can't walk out and see the pool at any time. I mean, there's never a sense where it is all about indoor-outdoor living. You're sitting inside, you're looking outside. If you're sitting outside, you're looking inside. There's also a sort of symbol for the garden of earthly delights in California, which seems to be lattice work. And not only are they in hairdressers' parlors, but they're in people's homes. I mean, it's a real, and the bistro restaurant, and people's porches and tennis courts, and if you look at Shampoo carefully, you'll see lattice work nearly everywhere. And it becomes a theme throughout the picture. Fresh flowers are a theme throughout everywhere except for Warren's dump. People have fresh flowers. And everywhere you look, if possible, there's a mirror. And there are a lot of shots in Shampoo where there are mirrors and people are checking themselves out. It's all part of that sort of vain quality. The bistro is full of mirrors. The beauty shop, of course, is full of mirrors. The office, Jack in, has a big mirror in it. His house has a lot of mirrors in it. The dressing rooms with mirrors all over the place. And you begin to collect a series of physical things that belong to just that movie. And they're shot in a certain way, whereas Chinatown is an absolutely straight-on negative. A lot of black and a lot of tan, grassy colors, burnt yellowish colors. And a very dense negative, very rich. Shampoo is a bleached negative. It's what we call flashed. So you and the cameraman, and you're always working together, the whole tone of Shampoo is much lighter. It's a lot of light in Shampoo, a lot of pastel qualities.
But you're trying for sterility, or affluent sterility?
Well, yeah. It looks as if, the picture looks as if, the moment you left that room, the maid would come in and clean it up again. That it's never been dirtied. You know?
Or lived in.
Never. All perfect except for Warren's very sloppy place, but you realize that it's all manicured. The lawns are manicured, the house is manicured. And if you dropped ashes, were you there yourself, somebody would be there immediately to pick them up. Now, that, aside from the purely physical things you're after all the time, that is shapes and sizes and connections of rooms, that gives a picture a very particular look, a look very much its own. The fortune is a simpler problem in that it's not a big picture. It only has few sets, all of which are built, including the exteriors.
Some reviewers have said that the set of the fortune looks like it's left over from Day of the Locusts. I suppose you've seen that.
Well, there's no comparison. Whoever that reviewer is.
I've seen it more than once.
You have?
Yeah.
Isn't that odd? Because it's a bungalow court, which is, of course, they're both bungalow courts. And it's like saying one skyscraper is left over from another picture about skyscrapers. Bungalow courts were very popular in this part of the country. Day of the Locust actually takes place in a hotel in the book.
I've read the
book. Not a bungalow court. And it would be they're so vastly different, the two of them, that it's like twins. I happen to be a twin. People assume you're the other one, the one that they know, because they don't want to bother to look hard enough. I mean, what they see is good. Obviously, that's him. I mean, it looks enough like him. It's the same thing with. I won't even bother to name the differences, which are enormous between those
just
two problems.
Just
well, the bungalow court in Day of the Locust was built in the tank here, in a shallow spot in the studio, and it rises up like that on a hillside, and it's attached buildings. With a two-story building at the back. The bungalow court, and it's yellow, the tan, and it's a very narrow, reasonably narrow walk. The one in the fortune is separate buildings, done in the very simplest California style, which is very sort of. The idea behind the fortune is, when you see the last shot, is the bungalow court looks like a series of small Greek buildings. They're extremely simple. They look, if you've ever been to Delphi or Greece, they look like the little temples that were. They're just like that, all of them, you know. And it looks like it's a play about three people, actually. And it's a little bit of a sort of classic play. They're all white. And they're built, the whole street is built on a big empty lot out in Culver City, where there's a real mountains around and real foliage and real sky and a lot of empty lots. The whole point of it was that in 1928 in California was a very small town. And empty lots and space was what we were really after. There are empty lots wherever you look, across the street, on the right side, or the left side, and there's this sense of this thing just beginning, California. Palm trees are only that tall in the front because they were just put there. And it's a series of choices made. After all, 90% of the picture, 80% of the picture takes place in this one little court. And trains, of course, and planes, and a few other sets like the barbershop. But if you look at the two of them, two bungalow courts, you'll see that there's an enormous difference. I mean, bungalow courts are, in the sense that you can call them bungalow courts, the same. There are thousands and thousands of them in California, in Los Angeles. And when you've looked at about 150, you realize that they have certain things in common. You know, they do look the same. But the reason the fact that critics might find them similar is such a generality. I mean, there's no way, shape, size, color, or form are they the same, except that they're both bungalow courts.
Are there any critics who recognize production design and give it its
yes.
Rightful place?
Well, some. Some. People like Frank Rich of New Times, certainly the trade reviewers, Murphy and people like that.
How about Sarah's?
I think, on occasion, I think it depends, you know, on whether after all, if a picture takes place in 1875, you figure they had to build it all, you know, and there's a certain amount of notice taken. If a picture takes place in 1928, there's also a certain focus for 1935 because it's a period film, and the period is either works for the audience or doesn't work for the audience. I mean, the audience is not that perceptive, but they either say this is wonderful period picture. For instance, Gatsby. Is an example of the 20s done in England, all of it, except for the locations. And a lot of people thought that it was a wonderful example of the period and helped the picture. I'm not so sure of that. You know, I'm not so sure that those were the right choices.
What
given
you're saying
the same
is they
period.
Weren't, right?
Yeah. There are pictures where more and more people are becoming aware of production design because when Dean Tavalaris did Godfather 1, they never noticed anything. But when he did Godfather 2, because it was 1910 in New York City, they suddenly saw something. Now, Gordon Willis, who photographed both of those pictures, by his peers, has never been nominated for anything. And he is, in my opinion, probably the best cameraman in America. So if the peers can't recognize it, it's very hard to imagine that critics would recognize it, since they're much further away from it. And it's very hard to separate at certain areas, the look of a picture from the way it's photographed and the way it's designed. I mean, the cameramen and art directors are all making the same film, and if they all are working towards the same idea, it comes out very clearly that this thing has a certain look to it. There were about 8 or 9 production designers, I imagine, 10. And the trick is that a well-designed film is a unity of ideas that belong to that picture. It's very hard to explain in detail because every picture has certain.
When you go to a film, can you tell who the production designer was without seeing his name?
Some people can. I mean by that I happen to know who people are. Most pictures are not particularly most pictures, I'll put it another way. Every picture has a director, but only a few of them are actually directed. And every picture has a designer, and only a few of them are actually designed. Doesn't mean that there isn't somebody there and there aren't sets there. But for what I'm talking about, it is accomplished very few times. So that it takes the difference between a picture that's designed and a picture that's not designed is, for the average person, not an easy thing to find, since every audience is perfectly willing to accept what's put in front of them, you know. But if directors have a personality and you know their work by their sensibility being applied to it, certain designers have a strong enough personality so that you can tell that their sensibility is being applied to the same thing, and certain cameramen. There are only 5 or 6 cameramen in the United States who have a signature in that sense. The rest all expose the film extremely well, but they are not doing anything. They're not artists. There's a difference between an artist and a technician. And a cameraman and a designer has to be both. The people whose choices are consistently interesting and right for a particular film, production designers wouldn't exist if there wasn't something that they contributed that you couldn't get any other way. Just like good cameramen, a few really fine cameramen are in an enormous demand because they make an enormous contribution to the picture. They unify it. That's what they do. They give it a particular feeling, atmosphere, color, shape. The real architecture of a movie is the people in it, but the sense that something is right, you get from the very best people. I mean, there is, like directors, there is a difference between Fellini and your average director.
they
both get it done, you know? I mean, it's both, it's 135 minutes long, and people are moving around all the time, and it's made up of a collection of shots. But even if you had on a 10-point scale, directors from 1 to 10, yes, dear.
Names of cinematographers, you say there are only a few that have signatures. Does Lucien Ballard have a signature?
Yes, he does. He's from the old school. And when I think of cinematographers, I think of Alonzo, Gordon Willis, Bill Fraker,
How does Vilmos signature?
Vilmos is very good. Laszlo Kovacs. There are some younger people too in this. Bruce Surtees, Bob's
son. Jeffrey Unsworth.
Jeffrey Unsworth is terrific. He's in England. He's wonderful. There's Giuseppe Rotuno. There's, of course, Sven Nykvist. They are really better than the other people. I mean, they're better. It's staggering that although everyone realizes they're better, there are certain kinds of films made where they are of no, where they're not wanted because they're so special. There are a lot of films made like that, and there are a lot of cameramen to fill those, and designers to fill those other roles, which are sort of product stuff. I mean, they're not. There's nothing particularly interesting, and the time that it takes and the money that it costs are all avoided, and they only and you can't have a great cameraman on a picture that is not going to make the difference. I mean, or a great designer is not going to make the picture successful by any means. Nobody goes to the movie to see the sets or to see how it's photographed. And a great many pictures will succeed that are moderately well photographed. I mean, exposure is there. There's nothing really visually interesting, but those are subtleties that a lot of people are willing to forego. A lot of people are not. I mean, we haven't seen Sven Nykvist take a crack at an American movie yet. He will someday, I hope. I did a Rotuno when he was Fellini's cameraman. I did a picture called Carnal Knowledge with. And he's very good. He's really very good. And even older cameramen like Bob Surtees is a wonderful cameraman. I did the Graduate with him, but many years ago, he's a young man in his head. I mean, his method is not old-fashioned. But we all expect to make a motion picture better. Or the attitude is, if I'm going to do a detective picture of the 30s, they've never done it right before. It's never been photographed right before. It's never been designed right before. And that's the attitude that you take. In other words, you're trying always to push the medium a little bit further. We don't expect an audience, the general audience, to see all those subtleties, but they do affect an audience. I mean, a badly photographed film can be very successful, and a badly designed film can be very successful. On the other hand, the attempt always is to make pictures that are visually more interesting and emotionally more interesting and the level of the quality is higher. That doesn't, in a business, an entertainment business, that doesn't always happen. But the attempt is always there on the part of certain people to, certain directors find designers, and usually they stick together for quite a while, and cameramen. The ideal situation is to have three people who know each other, the shorthand is there after a certain number of years, and they're in tune with each other, and the result is always very interesting now.
But you're with two directors now who I think are making good films, but are making uncommercial films, Frankenheimer and Nichols. Why? Can you hazard a guess?
Well, between, let me put it this way, between Rosemary's Baby and Chinatown, Roman made two very unsuccessful movies. Now, I didn't do the other two. Between Manchurian Candidate and up until The French Connection, two, John Frankenheimer, with the exception of Grand Prix, which I think made money, I did Manchurian Candidate and Grand Prix with John. But I didn't do all the others. And French Connection 2, he got everything right again, it seemed to me. I mean, he had very good people with him, he had a very good story, he had a very good producer, he had a good star, and he had the kind of vehicle that was very good for him. I've done all of Nichols' films. When you consider all of them, starting with Virginia Woolf, The Graduate, Catch 22, Carnal Knowledge, and The Fortune and Dolphins, two of them were, one was enormously successful, two of them were very successful, Virginia Woolf and Carnal Knowledge. Catch 22 was a very expensive picture, unfortunately. I think it's a wonderful picture. The Dolphins is respectable, but we all strayed away from our best instincts, I think. I mean, that's not the kind of a picture we all should have been making. It's not the kind of picture Buck should have been writing, or Mike should have been directing, or I should have been designing, or Bill Fraker should have been photographing, for that matter. The Fortune is a wonderful picture to look at, and it's wonderfully performed. I think that had it not been Mike Nichols, and it had not been, if Warren Beatty were not a star and Jack Nicholson were not a star, and people hadn't expected so much, they would have been very, very pleased with that picture. I think it disappoints them in that, in today's market, it seems to me, it's a little bit small in size and in feeling and in emotion. And I think that hurt it. I don't know if, I think it will make money. I think it'll pay for itself. I think it'll do. But I think that there's a certain disappointment there, somehow, with that film. In it holds well in the theater, people go to see it, it goes up each week, not down, because it takes...
Across the country is this, or just in New York and L.A.?
Well, that I know of, New York and L.A., because I don't think it's open in very many...
It's open in Dayton, where Dayton. I'm from, two weeks ago, and
yeah.
I liked it very much, but
yeah.
It's dying.
I think it's just a little sophisticated, it's a difficult film for people. It's a wonderful little picture, and as I said, if it had been done, if it had been a bunch of strangers, everybody would have loved it, but everybody expected much more from this crowd.
Do you have an idea of
And I think it's beautifully done, and it is a little rather special in its tone, in the type of humor, in the language, you know, the way the language is used. Yes,
we were talking about the failure of The Fortune, also the failure of French Connection 2, which we really didn't...
It's not a failure. In terms of John Frankenheimer's work, it's really a terrific piece of directing. And it's not boring, it's well done, and it has things in it that I think are better than the first picture. Certain ways, certain choices that he made, certain scenes. But a sequel had the history of doing about 40% of the business of the original and costing twice as much. And all of them so far, there is something that they don't have the vitality of something that's original. People went to see Godfather 2, as good as it is, because there was Godfather 1. But even that slacked off, rather. Big few days, opening days, and then...
But most of us think that Godfather 2 is a better picture.
Yes, but audiences are not most of us. Audiences are all of us. Most of us have... It's very hard to decide, when nobody has a crystal ball, what's going to work. But I've always been in favor of something that's rather, if possible, to look for some strong sense of originality, you know. And as we were saying before, directors who have found their own people, like Fellini and his designer and cameraman, and Bergman and his designer and cameraman, and let's say Nichols and his designer and cameraman, and Altman and his gang.
Vilmos is no longer a member.
No, unfortunately, Vilmos was very good, and that's a beautiful picture, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. But Altman's in an area now where Vilmos is rather studied, very artistic tones, and no help to Altman, I think. I mean, I think Altman is in another, looking somewhere else visually. It's very rough, Nashville, but right. You know, it's extremely rough, almost semi-documentary look to it. It's not carefully lit and studied the way McCabe and Mrs. Miller is. McCabe and Mrs. Miller is beautifully handled. But I think Bob has obviously found people who suit his needs now, you know, and I don't think Vilmos is obviously the one to do it. He had a designer who was very interesting too, he doesn't use anymore.
Is this just because he's going farther?
I don't know.
Further? Or because they were getting some of the credit for his, like people would say, well, that's...
It's hard to say. I would say this. There are certain restrictions to the best cameraman and best designer. There are restrictions. And certain directors want those restrictions. Altman is looking to bust out of all restrictions. Now, to set up a shot and light it properly is a restriction. To have four cameras that nobody knows which ones are rolling and eight microphones is, you know, there's an English cameraman by the name of David Watkin who's very good, who makes that all make restrictions on, and very often directors like Bergman, you see that they want that. I mean, they're restricting themselves too. And Fellini is restricting himself. I mean, Amarcord is a wonderfully photographed movie, you know. But what Bob Altman is trying to do is bust out of all of that. That's why Nashville is so successful in that sense. He didn't have anything he had to stick to. He didn't have to look in any direction for, he just had a, you know, he was free to do what he wants to do. And when he's been restricted, although the pictures are very handsome, like Thieves Like Us, and he can't get out of that thing, and the pictures fail. They seem to be, you know, they just seem to unwind in front of you, you know, and not go anywhere. So he's found his own way, Bob, and it's very good. But nobody knows why one picture will capture an audience's attention. Right now, there are several pictures making a lot of money, Jaws most of all. And Jaws doesn't have to be well photographed, doesn't have to be well acted, it doesn't have to be well designed, it just has to be there. And that, the way they did it is perfect. All Universal Pictures.
The way they did it, you didn't finish that.
The way they did it is the way it was meant to be done. You're not going to waste your time. You know, it's the shark. And it works. Peter Sellers comes back after 10 years and does an enormous number of connected shtick.
Sure.
And it works.
Is it all Universal Pictures?
And have a look. They have the same look. Right, it's like McDonald's. You know, it's a franchise look. Very few people break out of that look at Universal. For some reason. I don't know why.
How about Foreman's... Foreman didn't make Deliverance for Universal, did
he? No, one is. I mean, the Sting... looks like the Sting should look. I mean, people thought it was wonderful, obviously. I mean, they thought it was...
How about Graffiti?
That wasn't Universal's idea of how a Universal picture should look, I can tell you that. As a matter of fact, it wasn't even Universal's idea of what a picture should be until the audience told them that they wanted to see it.
Well, Tom told me last night that Verna Fields had a lot to do with making that film come together.
Yeah.
Now, is she a Universal person?
I don't know. I don't know Verna Fields. I know that Haskell Wexler helped a lot. You know, he was a sort of... It was a tough thing to try and do all night and yet get enough light, not phony light, but enough sense of light so you could see these kids and the fact that it is basically comedy. You know, had somebody else done it the way you normally do night, it would have been very heavy going to break out of it. I mean, but I don't know what it is, you know, what it is that makes, I think Mike Nichols is this terrific director who will have, like everyone, periods where things are not going so well, and then come back again. I think Frankenheimer will too with Black Sunday, because I think Black Sunday is the kind of material he should be doing.
We were talking earlier about production on location. Well, how did you deal with Marseille?
I didn't do that.
Oh, you didn't do
no.
that?
No. It was done by a man who worked for me once. In France. Called Jacques Saunier. Who, when I was producing... S-A-U-L-N-I-E-R, Jacques Saunier. He designed a picture for me that I produced many years ago with Charlie Feldman called What's New Pussycat. And he's a very talented guy. And it was photographed by Renoir. So those are very good people to have with you. And they did a very good job on Marseille. I mean, that young cameraman that... Yes. One.
You are very, very articulate. I love what you have to say. And you you know what you're talking about.
So. Well, it's hard to describe designing. Take an example of Virginia Woolf. The play was done in a typical, or I should say, typical New England columned living room from an early American federal house. That's what it seemed to me, although I never saw the play. I did see a photograph of the set. It was done by a very good designer. Now you have the movie. And you start making those choices again about the people. First of all, they're pack rats, drunks, slobs. And if you really look around at universities, they're not, professors don't live in, some do I suppose, in very, very few. They live in these dumps and they keep everything. And you've already got something that's, you've already got something original because you're not taking the sort of generalized attitude, you know, the sort of, you're looking at it from another direction. If you take The Graduate, there are two homes in Beverly Hills. It's a story about a boy in Beverly Hills and things. The boy is another thing that the parents have, besides two refrigerators and two stoves. He's another thing. You buy him a red car if he wants a red car. He's just another one of their things. They paid for him to go to college. And the girl lives in the same kind of family. They live on the same, in the same area. Now that picture was done, all the sets were done in black and white. There's no color in the sets. There are two houses, one representing the girl, one representing the boy. The boy's house, all the openings, and the staircase, and all the doorways, are rectangular. But in the girl's house, they're all round. The staircase is round, the back of the house is round, and it's all glass, like a tiger's den. All the arches are round. I mean, it's a pretty obvious pair of symbols, but one is feminine, the other is masculine. And there, what's black in one place is white in the other. The floor is black, the other floor is white. You know, the walls are all white, but I mean, you just keep... Now, it's very much like that when you look around those houses in Beverly Hills. They're all alike in a certain way. I mean, there's a lot of different, on one street you'll see 16 different styles of architecture, but for the story of The Graduate, the similarity is what was important, not the difference between the two families. I mean, you could be very far out about The Graduate, and if it were ever redone in another way, it would be very interesting had it taken place in 1925. You would have picked the Green and Green house in Pasadena and for one family, and the Frank Lloyd Wright house in Los Angeles, and had, you could have done Romeo and Juliet.
What was the first house?
Green and Green. Green and Green were two very brilliant
G-R-E-E-N without a
brothers, two G-R-E-E-N-E, died at in the 30s or 40s, two local geniuses who did about 25 houses here and some in Carmel. The Gamble House in Pasadena. I mean, there are volumes out on their work. They're really amazing. And they're very California. But you could have done something where you had, after all, there is something of Romeo and Juliet in that anyway, in an odd way, these two families and their two children and what happens to them. But
yeah, it's not really a realistic picture.
No, it's not at all. It's not at all. And life isn't, ain't art, as they say. And what I'm always trying to do is to get is to make that happen. In other words, to have the art and have the life. But there's nothing it's to nobody's credit to make a photographic copy of something. You have to bring something else, because you're making a movie. You're not making life, you're making this film. And what's so interesting to all of us about the great films is that they're very stylized. Very stylized. I mean, the best Orson Welles pictures are highly stylized films. Citizen Kane is just totally stylized. And I think that the American audiences, after all, it was another failure, Citizen Kane. No Jaws. There. You keep, if you're an artist, you can't, I mean, if you believe you're an artist and you have a certain choices to make, you make choices that are basically taking life and putting it through your own sensibility and coming out with a decision, a choice, collecting all those choices because of the nature of a certain piece of material. You don't have technical problems, you have dramatic problems. How do I make this story A, visually interesting, and B, clearer? I mean, what can I add to the clarity of these things that are going on? Emotionally, every image that you put on the screen should get an emotional response.
But people don't look at films, do they?
Not really. They don't. I mean, only certain people do look at films.
I mean, the audience.
I don't think so. I don't think there's that. It's so much like life that they're very willing to accept. You know, there are pictures that are made of beautiful scenery. You know, I mean, they go out into the West or some wonderful place and they take these wonderful shots of scenery.
David Lean?
Well, but David Lean is sort of a 19th century illustrator. He's a little more interesting than that, you know. He's in his way, in that sort of 19th century way. Contemporary design is a little... I mean, David Lean tries to get an emotional response on a big scale from things. The desert. You know, I mean, the ocean. You know, it's like Woody's picture, Life, Love and Death. I mean, the two big titles. You know. Woody's picture looks terrific, by the way. It's the best looking picture he's ever made.
That's the only film that we've talked about that I haven't seen. He had a good cameraman, didn't he?
Mm-hmm. European, I forget his name, but
yes, I did too. But
testing 1, 2, 3. Hello, hello.
Okay.
Whose idea was it to do the visual pun of Martha's Vineyard? Was it really?
Yeah, but it was an accident.
Really?
Yeah. It was an accident in this sense, that I was looking for things, and I found a map of Martha's Vineyard, and then I realized what I was looking at, you know. But I was looking for things that might be in New England, and what might be from a Mexican sabbatical, what might be from a trip to Europe, you know, all the stuff that they collected. But not until I saw it did I realize that there was something there, and that nobody was going to get it anyway. I mean, but they might have liked the idea. I mean, they were very bright people, after all. I mean, the idea of a visual pun. There are two other puns in that are not as... There's the tin drum, which is behind the bed all the time, just sort of a... But the most interesting one is Summer Hill, which is behind George's head in his corner. And Summer Hill is about children. So, yeah.
What's the tin drum? What?
Well, it just, you say to yourself, what book now, at this moment?
Oh, Grasses, the tin drum. Oh, I see.
Yeah, well, at this moment, can you put somewhere, because nobody reads, you don't take a shot of the labels, although all the books were really selected very carefully. You do try every once in a while to find that one thing that says something. And it seemed to me that at that moment in time, in publishing and in intellectual circles, that would be the choice that would read best. And it did, because a lot of people read the book after seeing the movie. And you're always looking for those objects that, especially in a picture like Chinatown, where you try to eliminate as much as possible, take as much out, carnal knowledge too. Everything that's not absolutely necessary is removed. So that when you bring an object in, it's very telling, any object.
But this is your most cluttered film, because
yeah,
their lives are...
Of course, I mean, that's the story there, but even with the clutter, you get to a point where clutter becomes something else besides clutter. It becomes life, in that sense. I mean, that's sort of life. And taking things away is another way of approaching certain things, so that clear. Yeah. Robin, you want to go for a
picture? No, I've got it.
Thinking of buying a Mercedes, 71 Mercedes convertible.
Oh.
That I would love to have. And Robin French is very good at them.
Wow.
And it's on the lot, and we'll just drive around a little bit.
You
see, I'm not designing anymore.
Oh, you're just head of production?
Yeah.
Tom said ask you about the plans for Paramount, but I really wanted to talk about this instead.
Yeah.
Two questions. You started out with talking about The Fortune.
Yeah.
Did you want to say anything about that? I interrupted you about what you were trying to do in the design, or have we pretty much...
No, it was very controlled looking film, but the main thing was this very simple point. It was that California in 1928 had a lot of empty spaces, that it was very small, and that these people had arrived God knows where, Glendale, for all we know, you know, and that it was a lot of room here. It wasn't until 1942, when the war came, that this place filled up. This was really, I mean, Hollywood Boulevard was dirt after La Brea. You know, it was really small. And to put spaces everywhere, to keep looking for things, airfields that were completely empty and put your own little
building. Does this have anything to do with the film itself or the space idea?
Well, it does have one thing to do. They never succeed. In other words, it's always an empty gesture. There's always a hole in the plan. These people go from never works out. They go to a motel that's a dump, you know? They get their kind of Hollywood is the least, I mean, their idea of going west and starting a new life and having all this money and all of that. They bungle the whole thing, there's nothing, I mean, it's an attempt in a way to say that
but really on a very light level.
Yeah, very light.
If you think
last
getting,
question. Yeah.
You talk like a director. You really talk like a director. Now, what is the relationship, very briefly, between a director and, I know this is a long question, but can you very briefly define the relationship between a director and a production designer?
It's, first of all, it's mutually contributive. The director is, under any circumstances, the final decision. Only one person can run that ship, and a picture that's really unified is a picture that everyone on it, the director, the cameraman, the art director, the designer, are all making exactly the same film. but there's an enormous amount of understanding each other, and the relationship is very close. You can't separate at times whose contribution is what. Nobody looks for the I did this and I did that, that's what I did, this was my idea, but you put in an enormous amount of ideas, and a director will put enormous amount of ideas to you, which you finally, by a process of elimination, get the ones you both think are right, are the right choices. And you'll go off this way, and then you'll come back this way, and he'll go off that way, because you're trying these things out. You know, you're trying to discover what the picture means. And a lot of things in pictures that I've done are things that I put in. I mean, scenes. There's a scene in The Manchurian Candidate which was written, it was the murder of the senator, it was written in a library. And George Axelrod and John...
The milk scene?
Yeah, I wrote the scene.
With the milk?
Thing? Yeah. I said, that's not what we're going to do. We're going to go into a kitchen, come down the hall, and he's got a silencer, and what the hell good is a silencer if you can't make something happen with it? What if he's making a sandwich in the middle of the night and he takes it and stands there and we just see this thing come out? Well, you do a lot of that.
Did you intend that just visually, or did you intend the milk to stand for his...
Everything.
...milky liberalism?
I mean, it's one of those things that works.
Came together.
Yeah. I mean, something good always attracts... is larger than what you... always. Something that's really good always turns out to be, as George Axelrod used to say, better than you thought. Turns out better than you thought. And a good idea always expands for some reason. You know?
It's terrific. Just what I...